What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Where's the billions of dollars that people are paying to be on Trump's Board of Peace, where he's supposed to be the president of the Board of Peace for life? Nobody really knows.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join me today. Well, we are here to talk about corruption today. Kleptocracy, actually. And I am joined by two professors who've written a piece in the most recent issue of Foreign Affairs. It's called The Age of Kleptocracy. So Alexander Cooley is the Claire Toe Professor of Political Science at Barnard and Senior Non-Resident Fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. And Daniel Nexon is a professor in the Department of Government and the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining me. I should note that I am a graduate of Barnard College about, 100 years ago. So
thanks so much for having us.
Yeah.
All right. So you're making an argument in this piece that there is a way to understand Trump's foreign policy that people have been getting it wrong. So let's walk through that. What are the things that people, in your judgment, have been getting wrong when they analyze the kind of foreign policy that Trump is now implementing? So let's start with you, Professor Cooley.
Yeah, thank you, Mona. It's a pleasure to be on. So I think the number one thing that people get wrong or that they assume is that Trump's 2.0 foreign policy doctrine, because it is significantly different than 1.0, is a version of anti-liberalism that is realist, right, in its orientation. And realism presumes to be acting on behalf of the national interest. You know, the main arc of the reaction to sort of Biden's liberal institutionalism has been, we can no longer support these commitments to global governance, to globalism, to sort of foreign kinds of entanglements. And we need to get back to sort of the core definition of American interests, right? America first. Mm-hmm. Okay. So far, so good. Furthermore, there's a talk of a transactionalism, right? We're not going to be bound by sort of norms and values. We're going to have like transactions deals, right? And that is really the word of the day. Post-conflict deals, right? Economic deals in the Arabian Gulf or sort of with allies, all again on behalf of the American worker. The problem with this assumption, right, is that we are actually looking at a situation where two related things are going on at the same time. One is the deinstitutionalization or the kind of collapse of the policy inputs, the sources of determination of what constitutes the national interest, right? Across intelligence circles, the State Department, the bureaucracies that staff the interagency, right? In other words, the national interest.
Well, hang on, because I think you're getting ahead of the argument that you make. So let's back up for a second. So we're going to dispense with the idea that this is hard-headed realism. Right. We're going to dispense with the idea that even, I think you guys don't agree that it's some sort of ideological, fascistic or right-wing, but you call it basically you're arguing, and maybe Professor Nexon, you can jump in here. You're arguing that this is really about personal enrichment
yep.
for Trump and his cronies and family, and that that's the best prism through which to understand the way he approaches all of foreign policy. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think our overarching position is that Trump foreign policy in the second Trump administration is best understood as a fusion of really extreme right ideology with a kleptocratic or corrupt impulse. The article focuses on the kleptocratic side because we think that's driving a lot of the show right now, despite the fact that the national security strategy was a far-right extremist document.
Yeah.
But if you actually, given that so much authority is concentrated in Trump, Trump's making a lot of the decisions that really matter on foreign policy, and his envoys, his personal buddies and relatives who are off negotiating these deals are doing so in this, you know, kind of what we call a kleptocratic manner, we really sort of think that that is probably the more important frame right now for understanding most of what's happening in U.S. foreign policy. It doesn't explain everything. It doesn't explain why the Trump administration is supporting far-right parties and movements in Europe. It doesn't explain the behavior towards Cuba, for example. It doesn't entirely explain some other features that we could go into, but it does explain things like Greenland, Ukraine policy, what's happening in the Middle East, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. So let's scope out a little bit before we turn to some of those particular examples. Let's get a sense of the scope of this corruption, because this is unprecedented in American history. I mean, the amount of personal enrichment we're talking about here is like starting to sound like Ferdinand Marcos or Suharto or something. So Professor Cooley, you can fill us in on exactly how much Trump has enriched himself in just the first year.
Yeah, so it's certainly by many estimates in the billions. It's qualitatively higher than the first Trump administration. And also, it's qualitatively different in terms of the sources of the income, right? So most of the benefits that went to the Trump organization and family of sort of Trump 1.0 was in the form of licensing deals related to the Trump organization itself, the real estate empire. What you see with Trump 2.0 is in shoving aside the negotiating bureaucracy and bringing in personal envoys, right? We yeah. see direct negotiations and the mixed. Wait,
yeah, talk about the firings. Yeah. They yeah. fired a whole bunch of career people, and he puts in his personal cronies, right? Like Witkoff.
So Witkoff is extraordinary because he is a longtime associate and friend in real estate. He has been, and we've had special envoys before, right?
Yeah.
So in the sense, like appointing someone who's trustworthy is not in itself unusual. What's unusual is the scope of Witkoff's portfolio, right? Every single Middle East situation, including the talks in Iran today, right? But talks in Gaza, the Arabian Gulf deals, the Ukraine portfolio, right? And what we see coming up time and time and again, and we'll get to Kushner in a sec, is that Witkoff seems to be mixing the diplomatic side of things and how to achieve peace or negotiations, right? How to secure the agreement that the U.S. wants, right? With side payments, right? And other kinds of financial deals, right? So questions about, for instance, maybe these frozen funds in Ukraine can be reappropriated, right? For joint U.S. and American projects, right? So that's the essence of this. Plus one other significant thing that's important to note, which is a founding of a Trump family, Witkoff family, crypto firm, right? World Liberty Financial, right?
Yep.
Been at the center of some of these schemes that are now being reported on and uncovering. So in other words, the Trump family has created new business opportunities in Trump 2.0. So the scale, as you mentioned, it's in the hundreds of millions and billions, whereas before it was relatively paltry.
So let's talk a little bit more about the whole crypto thing. The Wall Street Journal's great reporting showed that 4 days before Trump took the oath of office, World Liberty Financial. Now, I have to admit, my eyes glaze over a little bit when we get talking about cryptocurrency. Yeah. But so if I get it wrong, please correct me. But my understanding is that Binance, sort of backed by the UAE, bought something like 49% of the cryptocurrency or something, or made some huge investment in World Liberty Financial, which went directly to the Trump family, right? And does Witkoff get it? Does he get his beak wet there too? I'm not sure. Maybe there was some for him too. But yeah, this was a deal that has layers and layers because there was also a pardon involved.
World Liberty Financial is a cryptocurrency business that was set up by the Witkoff family, including Steve Witkoff, and the Trump family, including Donald Trump.
Okay.
And one of the things that they deal in is stablecoin, which is part of this, I believe, is kind of allowed by the crypto regulatory stuff that Trump's doing and the Genius Act and things like that. But these are essentially cryptocurrencies that are pegged in some way to a fiat currency by a government, in this case, the U.S. dollar. And so what seems to have happened is that Witkoff brokered a deal with the National Security Advisor of the United Arab Emirates, who's also a prince, who also has a big control over at least some portion of their sovereign wealth fund and has big companies that are involved in making money. Right, so they did a whole bunch of business of deals that were sort of, you know, U.S. business diplomatic deals, and they seem to have negotiated that the UAE company would purchase, I think, $2 billion worth of stablecoin. And then that stablecoin would be deposited in Binance, right? So it was so they were brokering a transfer, and it was their money that was going into World Liberty Financial to then be invested to the stablecoin to move over to Binance. And this was at the same time as Witkoff was negotiating the removal of an export control policy that had limited the sale of high-tech chips to another company controlled by the same people in the UAE, that the national security officials had blocked on the belief that those chips would find their way into Chinese hands and thus circumvent the U.S. policy of trying to keep the Chinese from getting access to top-of-the-line AI-related NVIDIA chips so we could win the AI arms race, whatever that means.
Well, hang on. Let's just pause on that for 1 second and just underline it in black Sharpie, if you will. I know somebody likes black Sharpie. The fact is that this crew constantly portrays themselves as being tough on China. And that's, you know, sometimes they give that as the justification for kind of abandoning Europe. It's a, you know, we have our eye on the ball. We have to be really, really tough on our main international competitor. And that's China. And what this deal does, right, is undermine that by allowing perhaps China to get its hands on these chips that the Biden administration, for example, and I think the first Trump administration, had been keen to keep out of China's hands.
Yeah, Trump 1.0 had actually pushed the United States in the direction of a lot of these things like export controls and getting tough with China on a whole set of fronts. The administration expanded that. I think they were actually more aggressive and a bit smarter about it. And then Trump 2.0 seems to have mostly kind of unraveled that, particularly when there are opportunities for Trump and his cronies to make money, which seems to be what's going on here. And that is, I think, when we talk about the importance of shifting away from a focus on U.S. foreign policy as being conducted at a conception of national interest, this is what we mean, is that things that across the board, Republicans and Democrats would agree were in the national interest, or they might disagree on specifics, but they would all have an argument about what was in the national interest. Instead, what's happening is that those objectives, values, policies are being sacrificed when they run afoul of opportunities for self-dealing. And so that's why it's not just personalist. It's not just an individual who says, I am the country and I best represent the national interest, although that's what Trump claims. Mm-hmm. It's really about personal interest in that kind of pecuniary, private interest sense that's driving things. Then the World Liberty Financial stuff in the is just a really stark example of that. And the reporting on that has just been fantastic. And, you know, everybody dies wrongdoing. These just happen to be negotiated around the same time, you know, just coincidentally. And yeah, we had to overrule all of the bureaucracy and all of the professionals, but that's just because we know best and they're just the deep state and they don't understand things and they slow stuff down and they try to sabotage our agenda.
In terms of the anti-China hawks and the great power competition paradigm that looms so large in the first Trump administration, one of the points that was made over and over again was criticizing China for exactly this kind of behavior, these insider deals, private payoffs. In fact, in a number of national security documents, there was criticism of strategic corruption being used by China and Russia, but we focus more on China, right, to buy off a lot of these rulers. It was in the Africa strategy. It was in the national strategy. And so now you see a kind of enabling of very much the same thing, right? The fusing of sort of official agreements with private payoffs, right? And of course, no mention or criticism of strategic corruption. In fact, the dismantling of a lot of anti-corruption guidelines.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the dismantling of the anti-corruption guidelines. But I mean, just to reflect on what you just said for a second, I mean, you could say that Trump 2.0, rather than battling Chinese style corruption, is simply emulating it, right? Is that too much to say?
No, it's not. And one of the arguments that we make in the piece, it depends a bit on the partnering country, right? But we saw this with Trump's first trip abroad, right? He visits three countries, right, in the Middle East, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. And what comes out of those is very similar across all threes, right? Big announcements of massive packages, $600 billion, $800 billion, $1 trillion, right? All framed as agreements to benefit the American worker. Then you dig into these and you see some of them are government-to-government agreements, some are commercial deals, right? Like Boeing orders that were on place anyway. And then some are a bunch of private deals, right? Licensing agreements for golf courses, Trump's jet from Qatar, all sorts of things that are intermingled. This is exactly what China does, right? They combine the public goods and development loans that they provide with sort of the private payoffs. But the other thing that all three of these have in common is they're dealing with sovereign wealth funds in these countries, right? Which are controlled by a small family circle and can be directed relatively easily, right? To help supply the funds for these deals. So I think the similarities, especially in those cases, are really stark. Perhaps though, what differentiates them is that they're at an even greater scale than what China has been doing.
Okay. Now, let's talk for a second also about regulation, because one of the things the Trump administration did was curtail regulation of cryptocurrency. Isn't that right?
The war on crypto is over, right?
Yeah.
That was the declaration, right? And
yeah.
Dan talked about Binance, right? This sort of crypto provider that has been sort of key to the UAE deal and sort of launching and partnering on stablecoin. Well, Binance's founder was issued a pardon by Trump, right? He had been sort of in jail, and the crypto industry in general, right, was the second largest backer of Trump, right, after sort of Elon Musk, right? So there's some institutionalized ties there. So I think, you know, the way to think about this is, you know, the president and his family members and friends are setting up a crypto firm, and then they are deregulating, right, oversight of crypto itself. And then they are also deciding, right, on withdrawing the criminal penalties for those already sort of convicted for crimes associated with crypto.
Let's be specific, because this Changpeng Zhao, I guess, who was the founder of Binance. And let's talk about him. I mean, he was in prison for facilitating money laundering for, you know, for criminals, including child molesters. And that's the guy that Trump chose to pardon.
Yeah. And yeah. And the in the commentary, in the sentencing about all the things that he had done, where it's just, you know, very strong language about the nature of his crimes. Right. So, again, when we think about transactional politics, right, because, you know, one of the things that we say in the article, like, all politics is transactional. All foreign policy is actually transactional. Right. But I don't think a lot of people actually signed up to such, right, corrupt transactions.
Well, I mean, you can say it's transactional between states. You know, we give you this, you give us that. But this is about the personal enrichment of the president. That's a completely different. I mean, it applies to countries in the Middle East, you know, those principalities and so forth, where the public and the private are not divided, not separated at all. But at least in our society, that used to be the norm, was that, you know, it wasn't about. And of course, Trump has just blown up so many norms, including not being willing to put his assets in a blind trust or to agree not to, you know, engage in self-enrichment. I mean, this is off the charts.
So Binance had actually reached a settlement with DOJ. It wasn't just, you know, sort of Zhao, right? They'd reached a $4 billion settlement. And Zhao himself proclaimed that he felt liberated after sort of, you know, Trump sort of pardoned him. So I think the overall sort of tenure here is that all of these instruments of state power, regime power, right? Power of the pardon, the power of regulation, the power to set foreign policy priorities, right? The power to sort of bring in envoys are being wielded right now, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, in the foreign policy domains, in ways that they're being combined that we just haven't seen before.
And we don't know. You say in the piece that, you know, a lot of this is still somewhat, well, at least some of it is opaque because they haven't been transparent about the nature of these deals. So there could be tremendous payoffs going on that we still haven't been able to discover.
Yeah.
Oh, certainly. I think it's really important to contextualize some of what we've seen with Trump in a broader, in sort of what's been happening in the global economy over the last few decades.
Okay.
So let's talk about crypto for a second. I know there are a lot of people who love crypto, but it basically has two purposes. It's a speculative investment. You know, it's tulips, but with a lot more money behind it. And it is a way to evade loss.
Yeah.
So it's a favored, it's the favored medium of exchange for North Korea evading sanctions, for, as you say, international trafficking rings, for people who are doing illicit drug transactions because of it's difficult to trace and all that sort of thing. And it's become a very, you know, obviously there's a lot of money flowing into the crypto industry over the last, you know, 5-6 years. And that money has come back and really flooded American politics. So the Genius Act, the law that deregulated a lot of this and that opened the door to even more crypto, part of the reason that passed was that the crypto industry not only supported Trump, but they dumped money into races. So Sherrod Brown probably lost in Ohio because of a last minute dump by crypto money into Ohio. And in my state, Maryland, both Democratic nominees were contending for the Senate seat, came out in favor of pro-crypto policies because they were afraid of money being dumped against them in the primary, right? And I was super disappointed with that. And so crypto is, you know, this medium that facilitates money laundering, cross-border transactions that are illegal in an environment where that's been pretty robust for a while anyway, using things like shell companies and other in international real estate deals and other kinds of laundering. The second aspect of that is there's a geopolitical context to this, which is that a lot of America's privilege, a lot of our ability to run budget deficits, all that sort of stuff, a lot of our international power is based on what we call dollar hegemony.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the US dollar backs everything.
It's a reserve currency.
Yeah, it's reserve currency, but it also denominates a lot of things. So a lot of trade, you convert into dollars, yep. That sort of thing. And Yeah, I don't want to say that this is going to destroy dollar hegemony, but part of what happens when you start shifting to crypto as a medium of international exchange is it substitutes for the dollar. And so if you are interested in fact, some of the tech bros, like they in their utopian right-wing dreams, they want to destroy dollar hegemony because they see that as sort of, I don't know, liberal international order state. We need a network cities thing. There are ways in which these policies are potentially really detrimental to American strategic interests, both at the level of our ability to prevent illicit, corrupt, sanction evasion, all that sort of stuff, and the level of long-term U.S. structural power. And, you know, I think it's interesting because crypto has emerged as kind of one of the pockets of what we might call now American oligarchy and its relationship with politics and the regime. And there's a lot broader going on about international corruption and Trump's long-standing ties to this, but I think it's important to sort of not view this stuff as all kind of, it's just self-dealing. The geopolitical implications of this stuff are fairly far-reaching, just like the geopolitical implications of destroying and ceasing to enforce American anti-corruption laws and efforts also have these broader implications for, you know, how the U.S. wields power through sanctions, through anti-corruption measures, and also for our domestic politics.
Let's take a minute and talk about Quince. It is still really cold. I know some of us, myself included, are ready for this really tough winter to be over, but it isn't over yet. There's still snow outside, which is why I am delighted to curl up in my Quince cashmere sweaters. I will admit I went a little heavy this year. I did get more than two of these beautiful sweaters because they are lightweight cotton cashmere and they are perfect for either just wearing over a t-shirt or layering over a nice collared shirt so that you get a more professional, polished look. Quince works directly with safe, ethical factories and cuts out the middleman. So you're not paying the markup, and so you get quality goods at a great price. They use 100% European linen, for example. So their cotton poplin is crisp and holds its shape. Looking forward to that in the springtime. Cotton poplin sounds great. Quince clothing is consistently rated 4.5 to 5 stars by thousands of customers. Real people wearing these pieces every day and actually loving them. So, stop waiting to build the wardrobe you actually want. You don't need a closet full of options. You need pieces that work. Right now, go to quince.com/Mona for free shipping and 365-day returns. That's a full year to wear it and love it, and you will. Now available in Canada, too. Don't keep settling for clothes that don't last. Go to quince.com/Mona for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/Mona. Let's do a quick review of the ways in which this administration, Trump 2.0, has dismantled a lot of the regulatory apparatus for fighting corruption. So one thing that you mentioned in your piece and that I've also written about was that they announced early on in the administration they would no longer enforce the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is, you know, they claimed, oh, well, this was putting American companies at a disadvantage. But talk a little bit about that. What are the implications of that?
So Trump actually has always thought that the FCPA, for short, is a bad idea, right? We have some accounts of, during Trump 1.0, arguments he would get into with the first Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, right, the former CEO of ExxonMobil, right, talking about the FCPA. And it seemed that Trump just assumed that Tillerson thought this was a bad idea. And Tillerson was really defending it, right, saying, no, actually, it empowers U.S. companies, right, because it takes kind of behavior off the table.
Exactly. Then foreigners can't come to them and say, please give us a bribe. You say, hey, I'd love to, yeah. But, you know, yeah. The law forbids it.
Right. And so when you think about sort of Trump's own formative business dealings, right, in real estate where you're going sort of for contracts where it's dog eat dog, you know, where the graph seems to be built in, right? For him, payoffs and business seem to be sort of synonymous. And so you had Tillerson, the Exxon CEO, sort of pushing back on that. What we see now is a series of, even though these are on the books, right, the FCPA, a series of declarations saying that the FCPA harms U.S. business interests, right? Which, you know, based on no actual sort of finding or survey or anything of the matter, just sort of an assertion, right? The reconstituted guidelines from the summer that came out that were announced, right, said that FCPA enforcement now should be narrowed to focus on transnational criminal organizations, right? Which is sort of kind of weird because if an organization is a criminal organization, they're already illegal. Right. And they're engaged in sort of illicit kinds of behavior. So this is being interpreted as, well, pretty much turn a blind eye to kind of standard routine bribes and so forth. Many law firms are advising their clients, you know, don't go crazy yet. Right. Because it's still on the books and the interpretation of how it's enforced might change in the future. But clearly this is an attempt to shift the norm, right, that was very anti-bribery of U.S. companies overseas.
Yeah. We should also mention that Trump appointed another one of these personal envoys. He appointed Tiffany Trump's father-in-law, Massad Boulos, as envoy to Africa and also for Arab affairs. You know, like Steve Witkoff, he has a huge portfolio. Supposedly, you know, came to a negotiated an agreement between Washington and Kinshasa. And Trump, it said at the signing ceremony, everybody's going to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
So just, you know, there you go. All right. But so we know that the corruption is off the charts, that there is also an institutional element here, that the president is disabling regulation. He is enabling crypto to thrive without oversight. He is firing career people and hiring his own personal friends and relatives as important envoys. We know he took a $400 million jet from Qatar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But now let's turn to whether this is a full explanation of everything. Because there are certain things that he has done in foreign policy we can now sort of examine through this lens. So I think the best argument for your case is Venezuela, right? Just a simple kleptocratic attempt to extract, you know, he extracted Maduro, put in his VP who is, you know, more compliant, no effort to promote democracy or anything like that. And then the funds from the oil are going into an account where? In Qatar or someplace? No, someplace in the Caribbean. Where are the funds going?
It's in Qatar. And there's actually an argument for doing this, which is okay. Venezuela owes a lot of money to creditors and to people whose property was expropriated, say, in nationalization. There are a lot of claims on Venezuelan assets in the United States. So there is an argument that you don't want to park this money in the United States because then it would be people would come after it through the judicial system. And if you really want to use this money to rebuild Venezuela, then you would want it in Qatar. The interesting thing there is that the people who are bidding and getting contracts for the Venezuelan oil seem to be big donors of Donald Trump, well-connected, some not exactly your top shelf American petroleum firms, you know. So, you know, in a sense, yeah, there's a justification, but, you know, at the end of the day, it seems like with this administration, if you put things out of regulatory reach, and then there's what is happening with the money. Where is the slush fund? Where is this stuff going? It's like the Board of Peace, right? Where is the billions of dollars that people are paying to be on Trump's Board of Peace, where he's supposed to be the president of the Board of Peace for life? Nobody really knows.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the trading firms that Dan is talking about. And we finished the piece actually before Venezuela happened. And then we made a pitch, hey, can we include this? And no, we got to cut it off. But the oil trading firms, right, who are in on these deals, have been accused of bribery in Latin America before, right? So there's an actual record there. And they've actually admitted to scandals involving, you know, illicit payments. So again, this is out in the open. And I would just say, just the optics of this have almost become normalized in a sense. Yeah. Personal operation that then leads to sort of a no bidding sort of set of contracts to oil trading firms to create accounts overseen by who in Qatar. This is so out of the realm, all right, of what was considered normal. And it's actually been quite rapidly normalized.
Now, I think somebody could make an argument that, you know, yes, there's a tremendous amount of self-enrichment. Yes, huge corruption. And self-dealing is a big motivator in Trump's foreign policy, but it doesn't explain everything. Well, you said that in the earlier, Professor Nexon, but you could make a very good case that there is also the element of right-wing Christian nationalist motivations. So, you know, the relationship with Hungary, the relationship with Bolsonaro, you know, those kinds of things are not, they do. And the fact that Trump sent his vice president to go, you know, bolster the AfD in Germany and so forth. Not a clear economic motive there. That does seem ideological. What do you say?
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/Ohio's time.
Yes. I think first of all, so the way that I've tried to make sense of this is basically this way. Trump is a demagogue. I think he holds, you know, he's a demagogue in the reactionary populist mode, right? So he holds a lot of beliefs that are consonant with really far-right ideology, but I don't think he's fundamentally that ideological. And I think what's happened is that for various reasons, including the fact that he is the demagogue who will demagogue on the right-wing side of things, he has become a magnet for and attracted and been surrounded by and glommed onto by a whole lot of genuinely really far-right extremist players, Bannon, Miller. I think there's a debate, you know, we can debate about whether J.D. Vance is just an opportunist, but he sounds to me like he's a true convert.
Yeah, me too. And it doesn't matter in the end. If he says what he says, it doesn't matter what's in his heart.
And so they've been completely unfettered in this administration. You know, we saw some elements of this in the first administration where you had U.S. ambassadors playing footsie with the AfD or weighing in on the side of, you know, far-right parties in the Netherlands, or you had the Trump administration putting its thumbs on the scale in the presidential election in Poland in favor of law and justice, not the most recent one, but the one before that, which may have, you know, helped yet again law and justice get over the top on the presidential side. So you've seen all of that kind of behavior. I think those people, they love Hungary. They also like Putin's Russia because they see it as a bastion of, you know, anti-wokeness, cultural conservatism, natural hierarchies of gender, race, you know, et cetera. There's that interesting kind of backstory we get into there. We've written about this actually in our 2020 book. But so I think those guys are genuine ideologues. And I think that they are connected and have been for a long time by a transnational far-right exchange of ideas and personalities and cooperation that we've seen in CPAC for many years, that we've seen. I mean, we could go back to like the Breivik Manifesto. This is the guy who tried to blow up parts of Oslo and massacred a bunch of Labour Party youth at a youth retreat. Breivik's manifesto was full of American far-right talk radio. And there's been the circulation of this stuff for a very, very long time. And if you really want to talk about American far-right extremism, you're really talking about something that looks more like the French New Right in terms of its beliefs, which is a neo-fascist position, right? So I think that's doing a lot of work. And I certainly think that when Miller and Vance and others are involved and they're unconstrained, those are the policies they pursue. But I think what it is it's been synergized with Trump's own and Trump's family's penchant for self-dealing, right? For their desire to do corrupt shit, to put it I don't know if this is what the rating of this program is, but to do corrupt stuff. And so one of the things that we do speculate in the article is like what would happen if Trump leaves the scene and you get people who are less corruption, more ideological. However, and this is maybe where Alex can chime in, or maybe you have some additional stuff. This synergy is not at all unprecedented. This every single one of the kind of dominoes of the far right, movements that have either had that have subverted either unconsolidated or consolidated democracies, from Russia to Hungary to Israel, all of those have also been full of corruption.
Yeah.
And it's probably not an accident that that's the case. And part of the reason is that if you are stealing money from your people, being able to blame vulnerable others is a good way of distracting from that, or justifying, oh, yeah, he's corrupt, but he's sticking up for Russian interests, or he's sticking up for Hungary. That's part of it. And part of it is the corruption becomes a mechanism for dismantling democracy, for consolidating the media and all that sort of stuff. That allows you to undermine democracy within, to still have elections, but not have them be free and fair. Another reason is I think that fundamentally the ideologues don't really mind this stuff, because it's just like powerful people getting money, and that's kind of consonant anyway with what they think should be happening in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a partnership to destroy institutional checks, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's the way to view it, and partnership of convenience. And then you actually see the fusion of it in a lot of these European cases, right, where the AfD does get a lot of secretive money coming in from the Kremlin, a lot of support. We saw what happened with Marine Le Pen.
Absolutely.
So the two tend
And in to Great go, Britain.
That's right. That's right. And also questions about who was funding, Brexit, those campaigns. So the movement of money can serve both purposes at the same time.
It's easy to focus on, and we did in that book I mentioned, focused on Russia's efforts to inject itself into the far right transnational network ecosystem. There's a lot of American dark money also floating around here. The New York Review of Books ran a report some years ago that Mercer money was flowing very heavily into far right movements in Europe. So it's all interconnected.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's all enabled by this, by essentially the deregulation of flows, by the ability to launder your campaign contributions, and which is related to your ability to launder, the money you've ripped off from your people and you're sending into British real estate. You can divert some of that to fund Brexit pretty easily.
Yeah. And that's when we sort of think about, okay, how should we think about this in a global sense? That's why actually the anti-globalism isn't actually a good label for Trump, right? There are certain people in the administration who are anti-globalists, right? And supporters, right? Steve Miller, Steve Bannon. But Trump himself is a different kind of globalist, right? He's a globalist who believes in these partnerships, in the fusing of the personal and the diplomatic, right? He believes in not stigmatizing or not sanctioning, right?
No. I'm sorry. He does stigmatize democratic countries all the time.
Correct. That's right. Yes. But I mean, are those who he finds to be sort of political allies, right? He just doesn't believe in stigmatizing,
bad guys,
the Russian oligarchs, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's a different kind of globalism here, right? If you want to call it global oligarchy, maybe that's a more appropriate label. And again, I think this part of it has gone under the radar. A final data point here are the Trump cards, right? Here we are sort of offering sort of U.S. citizenship for purchase, right? While we're having now all of these sort of deportations and talks to sort of, denaturalize campaigns. And then citizenship is for sale, presumably if you have the millions of dollars And again, these are schemes that had fallen out of favor precisely because they were enabling money laundering, corruption, in places that had adopted golden passports and golden visa programs.
So let me raise one matter that is a little bit hard to fit into this scheme, and that is Iran, where we are currently looking at the president seeming, you know, the guy who, you know, ran against forever wars, et cetera, Middle East entanglements. It was a disaster. It was the worst thing ever. And now he has assembled this huge armada. Apparently one third of the U.S. Navy is now parked around Iran. You know, with the accompanying hardware from other services, et cetera. So he is really threatening and saber rattling. And why do you imagine he is doing this? What's your analysis of what's going on here?
So I teach a course on empires that actually, like, it's a like Star Wars focused course, but it's really about empires and imperialism. And we were talking about personalism because one of the themes in Star Wars is that the emperor is running a personalist regime with an intact bureaucracy. And the students were, you know, we're talking about this, and you know, the best answer we come with is we have no idea. Like, they haven't actually explained why they're doing this in any way that makes sense. So I would say that, you know, there are these theories floating around, but they're just theories. They're armchair psychology, right? That maybe he got really excited by what happened in Venezuela. He loves, you know, he's like, I can use force and I can be the big dog and all that kind of stuff. And so maybe there's some of that. Maybe there are clearly long-term very strong anti-Iranian sentiments in corners of people who are, you know, in his advisors, right? Iran's always been a bit one of the big boogeymen, right, on the right. And so maybe there's some of that. I think that it's better.
It wasn't just on the right, I would say. I mean, the Clinton administration and others, Obama, they were not pro-Iran.
Well, you know, Obama did try to do that. You know, he's trying to kind of reconstruct the Middle East through the JCPOA.
Sure.
You know what? Yeah, but yeah, I think you're right. I mean, obviously, the U.S. foreign policy has been hardline on Iran for like since the revolution.
Yes,
there's no question, and you're exactly right about that. But I was thinking back to McCain's bomb Iran joke. You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, but the key thing I would say here is that I rather than sort of try to focus on why, because I think at the end of the day there will be no rational reason for why we start bombing. Is that this is a consequence of the intense personalization of power and the breakdown of the American normal foreign policy and military planning process, right? The normal national security process. So when you get power concentrated very heavily in a hand of a single individual who is surrounded by people not because of competency, but because of loyalism, you get all sorts of very predictable dynamics. Think about how Putin miscalibrated very badly in Ukraine. That was what was going on there. You get yes men, you get people who don't want to say negative things, you get people. And also, fundamentally, when you concentrate power, the decision like this, and it's so concentrated in a single individual, they just do stuff because they want to do it, because they wake up in the morning and he can decide he's going to put maximum pressure on Iran. And then maybe he wakes up and he decides, you know what, I want to bomb. Or maybe I don't want to bomb that day. And when there's no normal process, when there's no other voices in the room, when it's all these people. And I will say, though, that that's the fundamental sort of structural condition. But other people have written very nicely about that. Sava Gudnitsky has done some nice stuff on this. Elizabeth Saunders at Columbia, Stacey Goddard and Abe Newman have their neo-royalism framework. Fundamentally, one of the things that Trump is really about is status. Like, he's driven, I mean, you could argue it's pathological narcissism and insecurity, but he really likes to be dominant, right? He wants to be in a position of status dominance. And I think that's actually a lot of what he offers to his supporters.
Yep.
There's a sort of economy of status. You can feel powerful through me. And so I think fundamentally Trump, you know, Venezuela, he was able to punish Maduro for like mocking him. And now he's like, I can exert dominance and status for the use of the U.S. military. And I want to increase military spending by $500 million. And I can just order these things. And I'm the commander in chief. And so I think you could, if you broadened our understanding of what kinds of goods, what kinds of pecuniary benefits people receive from positions of power. It's not just money. And this is the case for everybody. It's always status from being in decision-making positions. But Trump is particularly a black hole of status. And his political movement is really built on the restoration of status for, you know, white guys and people like Trump. So
what defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Yeah, I would say the other dimension of it, and it's not the primary dimension, though, you have the current negotiators in Geneva, right, have all been involved in these deals with sort of regional powers, right? And so we know about the investments of the sort of Saudis into Kushner's portfolio. We've talked about the UAE and sort of Qatar. And so if just from the sense of, again, what Dan said, the foreign policy formulation, how do you formulate what the U.S. position should be? You have two lead negotiators who are friends and family members, right, who have been involved in personal business dealings, right, in the very region, right, with countries that have, you know, very clear preferences about wanting this regime to come down. So, again, I don't think this is primary, but this is one of the complications, right, that this deinstitutionalization and this personalization creates, especially in a time of crisis and brinksmanship, which is where we are right now.
Yeah, I think both of those are quite persuasive. I would add only that it could well be that, you know, Trump was in his prime years of life when the Iranian Revolution happened. He's probably himself imbued somewhat with the dislike or and fear of that regime, which is not illegitimate. It is a terrible regime.
Yeah.
And he may think, look, it has never been weaker than it is at this moment. And if I were able, using military force, to tip it over, then I would be able to claim I did something that no American president was able to do. And he loves that kind of boasting, that he did something others wanted to do but couldn't. Of course, I will quickly add, the problem with that is that he has absolutely no strategic vision of how this would work, or even if it, even if the regime fell, what would come after. I mean, you know, all of those things are clearly not planned out. So I'm not endorsing this, but I am saying it might be possible that that the sort of the psychological and the political come together here in the case of Iran.
I think that's
I
think it also raises another sort of consequence of this, which is this kind of personalism, kleptocracy, whatever label we want to assign to it, is very short term, right? It's about short term benefits, gains, status, profits. And when you dismantle the policy planning apparatus, the whole question is, how do you plan on the after? What is this going to look like? Who are you going to line up, right? This is absent from all these post-conflict resolution kind of situations and conflict in progress situations where Trump, you know, wants to take credit. And this is, I think, the medium-term danger that, you know, places like Venezuela, places like, you know, Rwanda that you talked about with the DRC, Ukraine, you know, this is the other element of this. The short-termism, right, really sets aside any kind of sort of questions of sort of, you know, concentrated, well-mapped out sort of planning.
The key to Trump's thinking seems to always be go back to like some moment in time in the 80s.
Yes.
And assume it's that true. Your preferences got frozen then. I mean, his obsession, particularly in the first term, with like Germany cheating us and Japan cheating us. This is like 1987 protectionism, UAW workers breaking Japanese cars. It's all kind of antiquated and out of date. And I think that's really crucial to him. Even before his obvious cognitive decline, he really had very strong kind of impressionistic preferences formed in these periods that are decades ago.
They are. One more that just gets me, that because he's constantly saying it, is that, you know, in the 1980 Mariel boatlift, Castro did throw some prisoners and mental patients into those boats to send them to the U.S. And this is an ide fix for him now. He's constantly claiming that Venezuela and all of these other countries are sending us their mental patients and their criminals. It's complete rubbish. But it, you know, it happened 46 years ago, but it's so cemented in his brain from that era. Okay. Final thing, you argue in the piece that this is not something that we can expect to go away shortly. Why do you say that?
I mean, it's easier to destroy than to build. But, you know, if you dismantle a large chunk of U.S. anti-corruption capability and task force, which they have done, that doesn't mean that they won't still use anti-corruption as a political weapon to go after their enemies, which is what all of these regimes do. But if you dismantle all of that, if you drive people out of the bureaucracy, if you dismantle these processes, you have to build them back up. You need to rebuild human capital and expertise and processes. You need to convince people that they're, you know, good people, that they should go back in and serve their country, and that they're not going to get fired in 4 years. And so there's that element of that. There's also the broader kind of institutional element, which is really, I mean, I could get very macro about like the end of the current American Republic. But fundamentally, what Trump has shown is that you cannot enforce the laws on the executive branch. You know, no matter how much Congress legislates that you have to have this national security process, or how much they legislate that an agency like USAID has to exist and do things, no matter how much that's in the law, there is nothing to prevent a president from dismantling, demolishing it. There's nothing to prevent a president. I mean, as long as we have Trump v. US, there's nothing to prevent a president from doing every illegal thing he wants under the cloak of diplomacy or the use of force. I mean, we just don't have any of those checks anymore. And once you see you can do it, there's nothing to stop the next president from doing it.
Yeah.
And so I don't really know where we are. So that is, I think it's really bad.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a couple of other ways, too. Once you open the door to sort of seeing that foreign policy can absolutely be just straight pay to play, right? In all of these areas at a level we haven't seen before, right? This opens the door going forward. Right.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of one. And then the credibility here is really important, too. How are you going to convince good professionals to come back in? Right. It's the same problem Department of Justice will also face, sort of having lost so many sort of personnel. So building this up is important. And I want to end on a note that might seem strange for the argument that we're making. You know, I actually understand and I sympathize with many people out there who weren't necessarily Trumpists, but who start talking about, well, the system needs reordering. It needs to be shaken up. It needs change. And unfortunately, the change we got, right, this in the name of sort of anti-liberalism, right, was sort of shaking it up, but like shaking everything up. It was destruction. It wasn't sort of rebuilding with a set of carefully kind of calibrated, more representative or more of our time kinds of institutions, mechanisms, or fora. And so I think it's a double problem, right? Like, yes, we needed alternatives or a roadmap to evolve to go on to the next sort of phase of the world order. But what we have now has just been sort of deeply corrosive to all aspects of sort of international sort of governance and problem solving.
Yeah, I want to push back on that, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
I think the U.S. state was working remarkably well. I think our bureaucracy, all things considered, because bureaucracies have pathologies, was doing an excellent job of things like securing public health. We could set aside, you know, COVID was a mess, but that was also a leadership problem, right? But it was doing, but it actually, in the end, we did pretty well, all things considered. It was doing a really good job on food safety. It was doing a really good job on a lot of regulatory issues. There were problems, like, for example, the regulation of the airline industry and of airline manufacturing. But a lot of these problems were examples of places of regulatory capture or where regulatory authority had eroded, right? Where we weren't actually doing the legal, rational, bureaucratic thing. I think our national security apparatus was really good at its job. I think when it went awry, it was usually because of really dumb political decisions and actually efforts to twist it in ways that it didn't want to go. It wasn't necessarily as nimble a response as we'd like, but that's not necessarily a good thing when you run a huge global security system where you are the global leader in a huge swath of areas and where you are guaranteeing your own security and others' security and where you are reaping huge benefits from these deeply institutionalized alliances. You don't want like rapid change. You want that continuity. And so I think that the U.S. government gets a bad rap. And one of the things we're figuring out now is just how well it worked and how much we're destroying of that capacity.
Yeah. And, you know, I agree with that in general. I think I'm just trying to be charitable to those who sort of say, you know, how could you make the global international system, right, more responsive? And just this kind of, you know, shaking things up, changing things has become synonymous, right, with this complete shattering of institutions and norms. That's the direction that Trump took it in.
Yeah. Well, that opens up a lot of other discussions, including, you know, the nature of which institutions in American society were succeeding and which were failing. I agree strongly with Professor Nexon about the things that were working. I would point to other institutions. I mean, if we really were reform-minded, I would look at things like our education system, which I think is desperately in need of reform, and the obstacles to kids in the, you know, bottom fifth quintile succeeding in this country are pretty bad. A lot due to a poor education bureaucracy, but so many of the things we had before Trump and MAGA came along to destroy our international structure, we had an enviable list of allies and partners, which is now all in question. We had the world's reserve currency, which gave us economic strength. We had our political stability made people trust us to be, you know, to be reliable allies and also to be brokers when things went wrong in the world. People trusted us to come to their aid, and that was partly because of everything that we did with USAID, which gave us a good global reputation, that, you know, we weren't just acquisitive, you know, hegemons, that we were more benevolent and trying to spread democracy and trying to help less fortunate countries. Sorry, is this too depressing?
Well, I'm having flashbacks. You know, 2 years ago, I was in conversations with people about how the problem with USAID. 2 years ago, I was in conversations with people about how the problem with USAID was that they didn't brand well enough. That people didn't know it was.
Didn't know it was us.
Well, yeah. China had like from China on everything.
Yeah.
So the problem wasn't, you know, the problems we were talking about were how do we like leverage this better, right? How do we establish the American brand better? Not how do we, you know, destroy it. And it's just so depressing. I mean, the Trump administration, particularly 2.0, inherited an enormous amount of power and capability that had been accreted and built up carefully over decades, right? Nearly a century, at least, right, of American foreign policy. And that was built on complex systems. There were huge problems. Our defense industrial base is a mess, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But we're building complex systems that required huge amounts of expertise to run and which gave us this leverage, our sanctions power, our military capabilities, all of these things. And it's treated all of these things like they're just like there, like they're found objects that it can wield and they will always be there. And you can't, and yet it's wielding them and using them in ways that are undermining the very basis of those capabilities. And it's doing it for the dumbest reasons. And it's so depressing for people in our line of work, because I want to have debates with neoconservatives or with restrainers about like U.S. grand strategy. I want to have debates about, you know, should we be deployed in the Middle East? Should we be, you know, should we pivot more to China or less? Things like that. Those mm-hmm. are important debates. I don't want to be having arguments like, should we tear up alliances on a whim? And should we like, And, you know, and should we, you know, should we, you know,
threaten to invade
give away Ukrainian territory? Right. Yeah, threaten to invade Greenland right. because, like, it's bug on the Mercator projection, and Trump will then go down as having added territory. It's just the dumbest possible reasons, and it's so, so depressing.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have to end on a slightly happier note, and so let us be aware that the American people still their capacity for disgust is now being tapped. And so they're beginning to cotton on to what's going on. And if they react strongly enough, we can thwart some of the worst aspects of what's going on. So with that, I want to thank both of you for joining me. This is a really interesting and discussion. I learned a lot, and thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.